Okay, so it's my pleasure to introduce Eric Greenwood, who's visiting us from Case Western. So Eric finished his PhD at the University of Buffalo, just down the road from us, just on the other side of the border. In 2010 with Dion Stojkovic. And since then, he's been a postdoc at Case Western University in, what I forgot the name of that institute.
Circa,
yes. Yeah. He's going to tell us about why pre-Hawking radiation never becomes thermal.
Well, thank you for having me. So I didn't realize this was actually supposed to be more of an informal meeting. So I have like an entire, obviously PowerPoint presentation. So I can skip most of the beginning part if you want, but basically it's just kind of a review of all the stuff we know about black holes. Okay. Or I can just kind of go through it quickly, assuming most of you know everything about black holes. So this is work I've done in collaboration with Dmitry Podolsky and Glenn Starkman, all at Case Western. Okay.
Where is Dmitry now?
He's still at Case. Yeah, Dmitry's still at Case. But he's up for a job this year, too. So as I said, so this is actually a full actual talk. So the first part, if you can kind of see that, is about black hole basics. And then, so basically the idea is that I'll talk a little bit about black holes, kind of tell you the relevant problem that it is that we want to kind of address. And from there, we'll move on to how we're actually going to address this by looking at semi-classical radiation. To do that, because it's semi-classical, we're going to couple a scalar field to the background of a collapsing shell. So we'll review a little bit about the classical solution. So once we get everything set up, then I'll talk a little bit about the analysis, move on to the key points on why this thing is actually not thermal radiation, and then talk a little bit about the implications towards the question we want to address, which is information loss paradoxes. Okay. So quickly, like I said, it's supposed to be a full talk, but I'll kind of quickly go through this. So the most relevant things are, in 1975, Hawking looked at what would happen to a vacuum if I had an object which is collapsing. Okay? So what he kind of realized was that a collapsing object would then cause pair creation, right, in the vicinity of this collapsing object. So here I'm just representing that pair creation by, say, positron and electron pair creation. Now, what he also realized was that if this happens very close to the event horizon, one of these particles can actually fall into the event horizon, right? In this case, say, the positron, while the other particle, say, the electron, then escapes out into infinity. Right? Now, this is going to then carry away a flux of positive energy. Right? But conservation of energy tells us that, well, we have to pay a price for that. Right? So if I have positive net flux coming out towards us, then I have to have a negative net flux moving into the black hole. Right? Now, this negative net flux is then going to cause the gravitational energy, or the mass of this black hole, to actually reduce. Right? So that means that the black hole actually radiate away its own mass. Now, this particle, or this mass, is not coming from the black hole itself, but it's actually coming from the vacuum near it. But that negative energy moving into it is actually going to cause, again, the black hole to actually decrease in mass, right? So we can say that, well, the mass of the black hole is actually what's sourcing this positive flux of energy moving out towards us. Now, moreover, what's actually more important is that, well, this radiation actually tends to be thermal. Actually, it's completely thermal. So that means is that this radiation, or the black hole, decays into all of its available degrees of freedom at a particular temperature. So basically, that just means that all this radiation which comes out is only depends on one particular number, and that's the temperature of the black hole. Right? And it turns out that the temperature actually depends on 1 over the Schwarzschild radius, or basically just the mass of the thing. And the number of particles which come out is actually proportional to the square of the Schwarzschild radius, or basically just the surface area. And I like this cartoon. So.
Is there any relation?
In the original talk, more so. The original talk, I actually looked more at what would happen to an infalling observer. So in that case, the question was, would an infalling observer actually catch on fire and be destroyed before he ever made it past the event horizon? Right?
And the answer?
That depends on actually what coordinate system you use. So if you use actually a Schwarzschild coordinate system to describe it, then he's actually always in an accelerating reference frame. So in that case, he actually will measure a divergent temperature. But if you switch to, say, like a Eddington Finkelstein, where the horizon actually, you know, it's not dependent on a horizon, then he actually will measure a finite temperature and not actually burn up. So in that case, it does depend on the particular viewpoint you take in that particular case. So it's a kind of a tricky question.
But the main falling observer would be the Eddington.
Well, that's the more natural case for him, yes. Yeah, but you can technically do it because, as you'll kind of see later, you can work in the proper time of the shell which is collapsing. And in that case, it's actually in a Schwarzschild, reference frame.
Is that right? The proper time?
The proper time, yeah. But we'll see that in a little bit. Okay. Now, the nice thing about the Hawking radiation is that it solidified a previously known result, which were formulated by Hawking and others, which basically made an analog between, say, gravity and thermodynamics. Okay? So in this case, prior, all anybody knew was that a black hole was black. It had no temperature. So they originally wrote down these four laws of kind of black hole thermodynamics, which kind of made no sense because a black hole was completely black and had no temperature. But this result solidified that along with Bekenstein's conjecture of the second law of, or the generalized second law of thermodynamics, which then gave this beautiful aesthetic relationship between known physics and now black hole physics. Okay? So as an example, I just kind of jotted down the first law of thermodynamics, which then says that, well, a black hole, at least macroscopically from an outside observer, can be completely determined by, say, mass, area, angular momentum, and the charge that this thing carries. Okay? So this kind of identification is what's known as the no-hair theorem. So basically, the no-hair theorem says is that a black hole, just like, say, a gas which is allowed to move around over time, destroys information about the initial state. Well, a black hole gravitationally will do the same thing. So if I had an initial state, allow this thing to collapse, then the gravitational field will actually destroy or hide all the original information about the original state behind the event horizon. Okay? So macroscopically, meaning that all we can measure then is the mass, again, the charge, and the angular momentum. Okay. Now, these are, of course, also reference frame independent. So this whole follows suit with GR. Right? So because GR, you always want everything to be reference frame independent. Right? Now, all of this together gives us a very, well, we run into a very conceptually bad problem if you take all this stuff into account. So you have thermal radiation, right, which says that all the Hawking radiation which comes off only depends on one number, right, which is the temperature or the size of the black hole. Also with the no-hair theorem, which says, well, again, I can only describe this thing by, again, whatever macroscopic quantities, then what that means is that what? Hawking radiation should be completely independent of whatever matter I throw at the black hole. Right? So if I take positrons or electrons or photons or neutrinos or whatever, throw that into the black hole, as these things enter the black hole, all of its original quantum numbers must be destroyed, mixed up, or put into an entangled state, and then given off to an observer as just Hawking radiation, right? So something which is completely thermal radiation. So this is basically the big problem that we want to address, right? So the information loss paradox, which basically says that, again, since this radiation is completely thermal, it can't depend on any of the original quantum states, meaning that all the original quantum states are destroyed once this falls into the black hole. Okay. Yes? Well, there's different views you can look at it. Let's see here. So in general, not in general, I guess, but a mixed state can be an entangled state. Right? So when it falls in, you're just entangling and losing all that information as it gets in there. Right. Now, there are ways, hopefully, around this. So these are some of the ways that people have kind of conjectured over the years of ways to get around the information loss paradox. Now, it turns out that most of these will get rid of the information loss paradox, but they bring upon other problems or conceptual problems as well. Okay? So one is, well, since I have information loss, as these pure states fall in becomes a mixed state, then I must lose unitarity. Right? So that means that, well, maybe we just have to give up on unitarity. Right? So quantum mechanics, unitarity is fine, but once we go to quantum gravity, that has to supersede more regular quantum mechanics, therefore, just in quantum gravity, we have no unitarity. So that's one choice. Another one is, well, maybe as this thing starts to lose its energy, right, starts to collapse, instead of the black hole completely disappearing, well, instead we're left over with what's called a remnant, right, which is a kind of like a particle state, which is left over and has all the information hidden within this remnant, right? So in this case, we might not be able to get any of the information back about these original quantum states, but at least we can sleep better at night knowing that all this information is actually contained within something. Also, we can have, say, non-locality. One example of non-locality would be, well, the information which actually fell in, that information gets replicated outside of the event horizon, and you don't actually lose the information, right? So part of it's inside, part of it's outside. Another example might be, say, entanglement. So in this case, entanglement would allow information to be passed essentially from the particles which fall in and along with its pair, which escapes out into infinity, right? So there's correlations between these particles. So if I measure something about the one particle that escaped, then that'll tell me information about the original particle, right? Because these things start off in an entangled state. So there's different ways of non-locality, which I'll get into in a little bit. But one, like I said, is that basically just some mechanism reproduces all the information about the original state on the exterior. So it doesn't have to be just via entanglement. It could be any particular mechanism which reproduces that information on the outside. Right. So it can be non-causal, non-local, anything like that. Where entanglement's in a specific choice of that.
In this case, entanglement is actually just a
special
realization of
non-locality. Exactly. And then the last case is, say, well, another natural way is what happens if, well, Hawking radiation isn't exactly thermal. So if I go to, say, higher corrections in quantum mechanics, then I might have non-thermal aspects on top of this thermal, right, spectrum, meaning that essentially my radiation isn't exactly thermal, so I can carry extra quantum numbers, not just the temperature. So it turns out actually all three of these are pretty much related. Right, so the non-locality with the entanglement, and then non-thermal aspects actually have something to do with non-locality as well. Okay. Now, obviously, you've gotten from my title that what we're going to focus on is actually this, right? So non-thermal radiation. So to address this, what we're going to do is do semi-classical radiation. Okay. So what I mean by that is we're going to just couple the scalar field to the background of a collapsing shell, and I'm going to allow this shell to collapse classically. Okay. Now again, what we're going to be in particular interested in is an asymptotic observer, right? So somebody out at a spatial infinity. So astrophysically, that is the more sensible person to take, right? Because we're going to be watching a black hole from far away. So we want to take the view reference of this guy. Okay. Now what's going to happen is essentially say this is where my shell is initially. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at an infinitely thin shell. Okay. Start this off at some initial radius, say R0, and allow this thing to collapse upon itself down to its Schwarzschild radius. Okay? So it means I'm going to have two different regions of interest, right? So I'm going to have region 1, which is outside of the shell, and then region 2, which is located on the interior of the shell. Okay? So as I said, we're going to look at a collapsing shell, a spherically symmetric shell, which then is only going to be represented by an infinitely thin domain wall, which is going to have a mass m and a radius which depends on time. Okay. Outside, due to the spherical symmetry, we know that the metric must be Schwarzschild, right? And then on the inside, it must be flat Minkowski space. Okay. So that means that what? If I want to couple a scalar field to the background of this collapsing shell, well, I can then just write down the action for the scalar field. I can decompose my modes, or my scalar field modes, into a time-dependent part, which is basically going to be like a time-dependent creation or annihilation operator, times then a basis function, which in this case I'm going to choose to be real, which only depends on, say, the spatial part. Now, since I have different metrics on the inside and the outside, right, I have to split this into two different pieces. Right, so I'm going to have an action on the inside.
Yes.
I'm sorry? Yeah, it's just the simplest case to look at. Yeah, all the other ones should be about the same, but you should just pick up extra like gray body factors and stuff like that. At this time, no. So that's something we have to take into account kind of later. But yeah, for now, yeah, it's just a test. That's right. So again, since I have two different metrics, right, one on the outside, one on the inside, then I have to separate my action into two pieces, right, one on the inside and then one on the outside. So if I do that, then my inside piece looks like this and my outside piece looks like this. Okay? Now, on the inside, I have a one time. On the outside, I have a different time. But I can use a coordinate transformation then to relate those two times together. The way that you usually do that is by using the proper time of the shell. Okay? So I have a third time, proper time of the shell, and then I can relate these two times together. Okay? So here I'm then just relating the asymptotic observer time or the Schwarzschild time for the inside and the outside. Okay? So B here is capital R, which is the radius of the shell itself, which is going to be time dependent. And then little r is then just the usual radial all the way out to infinity. Okay? Now what we really care about is what happens when this thing gets very close to the horizon. Right? So you can assume or what should make sense is that most of the particle production is going to happen when this thing actually gets very close to the horizon. Okay? So what that means is then I want to take my dominant terms from these particular actions. Right? So what we notice is that what? This one is divergent. Right? This action is also divergent, but this one I have to integrate over. Right? So this one is actually going to be logarithmically divergent, where this one is essentially linearly divergent, right? 1 over r. This term here actually goes to 0, which means then I'm just left with this piece of the action. Okay? So that means that I can take the kinetic part from the inside and then take the gradient part from the outside. Okay? So my total action then, if my laptop will work, is then just going to be a piece from the inside and then a piece from the outside. Actually, that should say total, not in, but that's OK. Okay? So near the horizon, then my kinetic part is going to come from the inside. And then my gradient term is going to come from the outside piece. Okay? Then decomposing my scalar field again into a mode decomposition, then I can write now my total action this way, where now I'm left with these particular matrices. Right? So matrices M and N. Mm-hmm. Now, using a principal axis transformation or diagonalization, I can then diagonalize these two matrices, right? And then that gives me a Hamiltonian, which is now, say, for a single mode, just given this way. Okay? Now, this is nothing more than what? Hamiltonian of a simple harmonic oscillator, which happens to have a time-dependent mass, right? Because B is time-dependent, right? Depends on the radius of this particular shell. Now, what I want to do is then I can use the Schrodinger picture and then write my wave or my Schrodinger equation this way, okay? Where all I've done here is I've divided by through by a factor of b. Okay? So I'm now defining a new time coordinate, eta, which is going to act as my new time or my conformal time, and then giving me this particular Schrodinger equation. Okay? So basically, in one way, you can imagine that what we've actually done is then change the time-dependent mass into a time-dependent frequency, okay, in this particular coordinate system. So what should happen is what? By solving the Schrodinger, or this functional Schrodinger equation, then all of my information about this collapse is going to be contained within the wave function itself, or the wave functional. Okay? So we're going to actually solve this using two different methods. So I'm going to use the functional Schrodinger first, solve it that way, and then use the Heisenberg picture or the quantum kinetic equation and then solve it this way as well. Okay. Now what we'll find, which I don't get in too much detail, but they're actually identically the same, right? So they give us the same results, which they should, right? So first let's look at the Schrodinger picture. So it turns out that there's actually an exact solution for this particular wave function. So if I have a time-dependent frequency, my wave functional is actually given this way, where rho here is the solution of an auxiliary nonlinear equation. Okay? So here, this then just depends specifically on how this frequency depends on time. Okay? So again, as I said, if I solve this, then my wave functional actually contains all the information about the original or about the collapsing system. Okay? Now, what we're interested in then, though, is the spectrum of particles which come out, right? So I'm just going to calculate the occupation number of this particular spectrum. So to do that, then all I want to do is then take the expectation value of the number of particles which is given off, right, as a in respect to time. So the Cn here is nothing more than the Gaussian overlap between this wave functional and whatever basis function I expand this in, right? So since this is a harmonic oscillator, I'm just going to expand it in harmonic oscillator basis functions, right? So using this, doing some calculation, I can plug this into this expectation value, and then finally I found that my occupation number should be given this way, right? So this is then going to depend on a frequency. Now what we're going to be mostly looking at is a fixed frequency, and then look at the time evolution of this. Okay? Well, it does. That's actually where this eta comes into account.
If you're looking at, what matters is if an observer carries a detector.
Right.
And then the response of the detector is something physical that doesn't depend on the words.
But it does. Right. So if I had, actually what we were talking about at the beginning, is if I had an observer out at infinity, right, he's going to measure a finite temperature, right, in the Hawking case. So he measures a finite temperature, has a particular Planck distribution, right? But then if I had an infalling observer, he's going to measure different particles than what the outside observer is going to measure.
No, sure, but those are two different observers.
Right, so in this case.
They're done different trajectories, but what I mean is, for example, when you look at on radiation, when you want to find the spectrum, all you do is you integrate the two-point function
right.
over the proper time.
Right.
That doesn't depend on what coordinates.
But that depends on which trajectory.
It depends right. on the trajectory. But not on the coordinate.
But the trajectory does depend on the coordinate system.
Well, I think we're probably just getting confused from the
okay.
As a matter of principle, you would agree that given any system, your answer should not depend on what coordinate system you chose to write it in, despite the fact that there are, depending on the system, it's natural to write it in different coordinate systems. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me happy.
Okay. Yes. So I guess all I'm saying is anytime you're asymptotically away, right, the most natural coordinate system to use would be Schwarzschild in that case. Right? I mean, I can choose other coordinate systems if I want to, but as long as I'm that asymptotic observer away, I'm still going to measure the same thing. So in that respect, yes, it's going to be independent of the coordinate system that I chose. But what I mean by the difference in coordinate systems is choosing different observers, right? So in that case, you know, if I want the asymptotic observer versus the infolding observer, then in that case, that's what I mean by different coordinate systems in that case.
The thing that's happening here is these particles, how do you know they reach the guy at infinity? Because these are particles everywhere in your hypersurface.
Right, so you're imagining that he does have a detector. So his detector basically is given essentially just by this, right? So the overlap of what he measures, right? So this wave function is what would actually make it to him, right? So this is the, again, kind of his detector or his overlap between what makes it to him and then what he has.
But
oh, like I said, so that is basically what his vacuum is. Right.
What are your modes? How do you define your modes?
So the original modes?
Yeah.
Right, so this way.
Well, that's very vague. So what are FKs?
So FKs, for the most part, we don't care about FKs. We will in a little bit. I'll talk more about that. But in the original papers by Dayan and Lawrence Krauss and Tom Aviatchaspate, basically they argue that this doesn't matter. The basis functions don't matter. And the reason is because they diagonalize these particular matrices. Okay? So they didn't want to choose what these basis functions look like, so these are just general type basis functions. So your basis functions would come from what? Solving basically box phi. Right? So I'd solve box phi, that would tell me what my particular basis functions are. Right? But for the most part, we're just not going to worry about the basis functions. Right. Well, yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah. Gotcha. No problem. So, all we're saying is what we want to do is compare these two terms together. Right. Here, let me. Kind of break something. So remember that B is actually equal to what? 1 minus RS over R. Okay. So that means that what? Basically, the kinetic term for the inside part is divergent by like 1 over R minus RS. From the outside piece, I have an R squared here, right? And then I have to integrate this over R, right? So I have a dr R squared, and then I'm integrating this term. So this term itself will actually be, what, logarithmically divergent. So the argument goes is that, what? Since this one is, what, 1 over R minus RS divergent, this one is logarithmically divergent, it is subleading to that first one. Well, because this one depends on capital R, which is the radius of the shell.
Okay.
Right, so remember there's two different R's going on here. So, yeah. So like down here, this one depends on capital R, which is the radius of the shell.
Okay.
Right? So this one does not depend on it.
You're essentially making an approximation that the action is dominated by the shell.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're saying that's where most of the particle production is going to happen. So before that, you know, I might get some particle production, but for the most part.
Do you understand? I mean, that's not So if I use Kruskal type coordinates or something, you're making these approximations in the coordinate system, which is going bad at the point where you're making the approximation, which you can sometimes get away with, but sometimes gets you into trouble.
Right, right. So one thing we did check was we went back, calculated what the basis functions were, and then made sure that, yeah, this term was dominant over this term, just to make sure, in these particular Schwarzschild coordinate system. So we made sure that that was dominant.
As long as the coordinate system does not go bad, you're okay.
Yeah, but he's making an approximation. So if something is going divergent, in some sense, that's just because he chose a bad coordinate system, and then he's dropping some term because it's looking small in that coordinate system.
So, right, but I mean,
I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm just saying there's some point to be worried about here.
Right, right. So this is, yeah, something we kind of keep going back and forth on. But I mean, for an asymptotic observer, the most natural coordinate system to use is the Schwarzschild case. Right, so not Kruskal.
Well, that's but essentially every, well, there are essentially every coordinate system you generate anyway. So.
Right, true. Since it's asymptotically Minkowski. Right, but yeah.
Which?
Well, yeah, so we're keeping a kinetic and a potential term. Well, the potential is, right, this term. So this goes as the gradient term.
Oh, because of the gradient.
Yes, yeah. So the gradient term we call the potential term. Well, no, because this goes linearly as R minus RS. Right, so this goes to zero in the near shell, in the near horizon limit. That's correct. So this one, my laser pointer keeps dying, but that's OK. So this term goes to zero, where this term will give me at least a finite answer. Right, so it's non-zero. So, but yeah, overall, this term is the most important, right? Because that's going to be the largest term, correct? So that's right. Let me go back to where I was. So anyway, so yeah, so to find then my occupation number, all I have to do then is solve a nonlinear second order equation for rho, and then that's basically going to give me all the information, right, about the spectrum.
I want to iterate what I said. You still haven't said what particles an observer at any point is. You just said what particles exist in your
brain.
But he's
calculating response function in
infinity. No, it's not response function.
Well, it's not a response, right.
It's
but
the number of particles.
Right. Correct.
But I assume most of you are going to look at it near infinity and expand from some of the loops there? Or?
Not exactly. No.
Well,
okay. Sounds good. An alternative way I can do this is to, right, go to the Heisenberg picture. So here, then, we can use what Hamilton's equation of motion, right, rewrite the Hamiltonian. This way, and then define, say, time-dependent creation and annihilation operators given this way. Okay. So by taking derivatives of the creation and annihilation operator, right, then I can look again at the expectation value of the occupation number, and then I have an anomalous, these are related at least, to the anomalous creation and annihilation terms, right, which are going to be non-zero because I have a time-dependent metric. Okay, so note here I've just switched back to the asymptotic observer time instead of the conformal time. Okay. So in this case, then, instead of having, what, one second-order nonlinear differential equation I have to solve, I now have three coupled first-order differential equations I have to solve. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what I said is we want to do this semi-classically, right? So I want to look at the case of a classical shell, right? So in this case, basically, I'm going to revisit this, but just get rid of the radiation part. I just want to know what is the time dependence of this overall shell. So again, I still have this region outside and this region inside. So the easiest way to solve this, again, is since I'm choosing that this thing is infinitely thin, is just using Israel junction conditions. Right? So it turns out that Ipsner and Sakivi, back in 1984, actually solved this particular case. Right? So they had a spherically symmetric domain wall collapsing upon itself. And what they found is that the mass is actually given this way, where tau here is actually the proper time of an observer who's actually riding on a shell. And what they found is actually that this mass is actually a constant of time. Right? So if I take the time derivative of this in respect to proper time, it just gives me zero. Right? Now, since this is a conserved quantity, it's basically the total energy of the system, we're going to treat this then as the Hamiltonian of the system. Okay? Now, this is taken in terms of the proper time. But we want to look at it from the case of an asymptotic observer time. Right? So all I really have to do is do a coordinate transformation. Right? So just find the action, do the coordinate transformation on the action, and then rewrite my Hamiltonian in terms of the asymptotic observer time. So to solve the system completely, it's very complicated. Right? I'd have to do it numerically, but I don't really want to do that. Again, what we said is that all we really care about, what we think, anyways, is that most of the particle production is going to happen when I'm very close to the Schwarzschild radius. Right? So we're going to take the near horizon approximation of this Hamiltonian as well. So Todd Mavie-Atrasbate, Lawrence Krauss, and also Dejan Stojkovic showed that the Hamiltonian, in respect to, say, the asymptotic observer time, is actually given this way. Mm-hmm. Or I can then solve for how this radius depends on time. Again, in the near horizon limit, all I find is that this is actually proportional to minus this b factor. Right? Remember, b is just 1 minus Schwarzschild radius divided by position of the shell. So the first order in r minus, or the initial position of the shell minus Schwarzschild radius, my position of the shell is just given this way. Right? So it depends exponentially on time. So basically, all this shows is that it takes an infinite amount of time for the shell to reach the Schwarzschild radius. Right? So classically, we know that's true. Mm-hmm. So that's been known for a very long time. OK. So now that we have this, now we can actually now solve our system. Right? So like I said, all we really care about is the time dependence of this particular frequency. Now, note, when I originally wrote down that Schrodinger equation, I had that the derivative with respect to this eta, right, which was this conformal time. Meaning that my original frequency I wrote down was actually a conformal frequency. But what I really want is the physical frequency. So all I have to do is multiply the conformal frequency by this factor b, and then that'll put in terms of physical frequency. Right? So the physical frequency then is given by the initial frequency at which this mode was induced, and then times a redshifting factor, right? An exponential redshift factor. So basically, my modes then are just going to get redshifted over time. Right? Okay. So let's analyze this.
So eta wasn't proper?
No, eta was conformal time. It turns out that eta, in this case, is actually the time taken from the viewpoint of an inside observer. So an observer who's actually inside the shell watching this thing collapse is what it turns out to be.
The problem with that is, the number of particles they define, if you go to another coordinate system, if you fix the quantum state, then what an observer sees, its detector click should
right.
not
Right.
But isn't that the case
here? Well, no. I think this is actually very similar to Hawking's picture, right? So in Hawking's picture, you had radiation which is coming in from infinity, gets redshifted as it's going towards the shell, right? Moves into the shell, then gets blue shifted. But since it's collapsing, then when it comes out the other side, it then has another, gets redshifted again. But since this thing collapsed, then the redshift it suffers on the outside is different than the blue shift which happened on the inside. Right? So basically, this is just kind of the same picture. Right? So all this is saying is if I work in the infalling or the inside guy's picture, then I have a blue shift where my modes are actually blue shifted over time. Right? Which makes sense because this thing is actually collapsing. Then if I go to the outside guy, then they are again redshifted, but that redshift is overcompensated than the original blue shift. Right? So I get more red shift than happened when this thing was blue shifted from the inside. So it's identical to Hawking's original picture. Right? So I don't know if that kind of answers your question or not. But like I said, so this is actually pretty much identical to Hawking's original picture. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I said, so let's analyze this. So first thing we're going to look at is, say, how the occupation number changes in respect to time for different, say, fixed frequencies. Okay. So one thing to know here is that my largest frequencies actually correspond to the smaller curves here. Okay. So basically what this says is that initially this thing starts to collapse, right? I start getting modes excited in particular frequencies, but then for kind of early times, for most of them, it levels out and becomes constant. Okay? Now, as we said, since these modes are getting redshifted, all this means is that the occupation number exponentially increases over time. Right? So I have an exponential redshift compensated by an exponential growth in occupation number, which is those two cancel each other out, which means I have a constant occupation number. Right? Now, the other thing to notice is that my smaller modes, which are being induced, takes longer and longer and longer time for this thing to actually reach a constant occupation number. Where if I look at, say, my zero mode, it would actually take an infinite amount of time for that to level out, right, or become constant. So, yes, sir? I'm sorry?
How do you get the ground state frequency for this harmonic oscillation? You
had
omega naught, omega zero.
Oh. Well, omega naught is just basically it's just a parameter, right? So it's the original mode. So it's the original frequency of the mode which is induced. I don't know if that.
Is it depend on the size of the shift?
No. Right. Let's see. So theoretically, it would. Yes. So usually, the particles which are given off are usually about the size of the Schwarzschild radius, right? But in this case, we just want to look at the complete spectrum, right? So all the way from zero into infinity. So we're not putting any restrictions on that is somehow related to the size of the shell. So we're just saying that this is just a particular frequency which is induced, and then plot that versus time. Okay? So it's looking at just the full spectrum of the occupation number. The ratio of the frequency.
I mean, in your previous slides, you actually.
Sure.
So here you have the dependence of omega t as omega naught. So in the previous slide, you had omega naught in one more. Here you had next one.
This one? So omega naught is just right. So writing this as, let's see, where's the best place to write this? Right, so all I'm saying is that omega, right, is actually equal to omega naught times whatever the time part is. Right. So it turns out that if I do it in terms of omega, right, so this is defined here. Actually, let me go back. It'll be easier if I tell it that way. Right, so basically all I'm saying is that omega is actually just this. I think I'm missing an m here, actually. So it is k, where k is the eigenvalue of this matrix n, okay, divided by the mass. So that's just omega 0. The time part comes in from this factor of 1 over b. Okay. So it means in terms of this conformal frequency, again, this gets blue shifted over time. So we're just saying that if I induce a mode with an initial frequency omega 0, then that just gets blue shifted as time goes on. Okay. So omega zero essentially is just a free parameter that I have. It's whatever mode, whatever the initial frequency is of the mode that was induced. Okay. Now again, if I go back to the time dependent, or I'm sorry, asymptotic time, then I have to take that conformal frequency, multiply it by another factor, b, which then gives me omega zero times the square root of b, right? Because remember, this one is omega divided by the square root of b. So then the actual physical frequency is omega zero to the square root of b, or since I know b goes as minus the exponential of time, then this is just given this way. Right, exactly. So at time zero, whatever mode was actually induced at that particular time, right? Okay. So again, so what I said is that basically what we want to get out of this is that, well, first that the occupation is actually exponentially increasing with time. Right? We can see that using our Heisenberg picture. Right? So here we can define a new parameter, say n hat, as twice the occupation number plus one. Right? Define two other new parameters, say f and g, as being this new parameter plus one of these anomalous factors, or subtracting the two. And then that, we can then rewrite those initial three coupled equations now as just two coupled equations, given this way. And these are nice and easy to solve, right? So I can solve using the initial conditions. Oh, so one thing I forgot to say is our initial conditions on this system is that this thing starts off in complete vacuum, right? So initially I have the shell. Let's imagine I hold it constant. So it's not moving, so there's no particles in the background. It's in complete vacuum. Then I allow it to collapse, which means all this particle production is coming directly as a consequence to the time-dependent metric, right? To the fact that this thing is actually collapsing. So in that case, I had that this n, x, and y at time zero are all just zero. Or since I'm now using 2n plus 1, then f and g at time zero are just 1. Right? So if I use that, then this gives automatically that f and g are then exponential time, right? F decays exponentially in time, g increases exponentially in time. So my total occupation number, using that n is roughly then just 2n, then goes as sinh, or if I take the time goes to infinity limit, this is then just exponential in time, right? So matches what it is that we saw numerically. So now we want to focus on occupation number now versus frequency at fixed slices of time. Right? So I want to choose different times and then look how this thing actually grows. Okay? So the blue curves here are going to be the numerical, and then the green curve, which you probably can't see very well, is going to be the usual case, which is the Planck distribution. Right? The reason we chose that is because if you look at these plots, they look very similar to the Planck distribution. Okay? Now one thing we notice is that here we see that this thing isn't quite thermal because down here I have kind of oscillations on top, which are non-thermal oscillations. But I also don't have the Rayleigh-Jeans singularity here, right? But what we do notice is that, say, this is time 14, right? So T over RS 14 is given here. T over RS at 15 is now given up here. So this thing becomes more and more and more singular as time increases, right? So you can imagine that the Rayleigh-Jeans singularity actually shows up at time goes to infinity, right? So when the shell would actually reach its own Schwarzschild radius. Actually, no. No. Which originally we thought they did, but we kind of went back and checked, and no, actually these oscillations stay the same, which I'll talk a little bit about more in a little bit. But yeah, but they actually stay there. So they. Right. Okay. So again, what we see is that the spectrum is non-thermal, but the modes near omega t here going to zero become more and more thermal as time increases, right? So the Rayleigh-Jeans singularity seems to show up. Now we can again see this using our Heisenberg picture. So what we know is that what our all of our values, right? So the occupation number plus this x and this y all actually depend on both time and frequency. So I can then write the total time as being what? Partial derivative in respect to time and a partial derivative in respect to frequency. Or I can define a new parameter z, and then I can solve for this behavior of the occupation number as a function of, say, frequency, which then gives me something that looks like this. Okay, so this is in the near omega t goes to zero limit. So for now, just ask you to ignore the time piece here. But what we notice is that this does have a 1 over omega spectrum, right? So what we know is that near omega equals zero, the Planck distribution should have a 1 over omega spectrum, right? So this is exactly what we see from this picture, right? So this seems to match rather well, except for the fact there's no singularity. Right? So you can say is that, yeah. So for at least small omegas, this has a 1 over omega frequency, or frequency dependence. So if we want, we can fit the temperature in that range, say omega near zero. Again, it's not quite singular, but that's OK. So we get some oscillations, but these oscillations do kind of die down over time, but not completely go away. So if I want, then I can, again, make a best fit line just by plotting natural log of 1 plus 1 over the occupation number. Again, plot that versus the frequency at a fixed time. And then this gives me that the temperature, at least the best fit temperature here, goes as just about the Schwarzschild, or sorry, the Hawking temperature. Right? Small difference, but not too bad. Okay. So everything starts to look good. So I'm doing pretty good at the moment. But what about the large frequencies? Okay. So to look at large frequencies, the easiest way to do this is to plot, say, natural log of the occupation number versus, again, say, our frequency. Now again, I'm going to look at, in this case, three different times. So again, if I look near the Rayleigh-Jean singularity, I see that what I have three different plots here. Right? So again, this becomes more and more singular as time increases. Right? But now if I look in the large frequency range, we notice is that the green line here is actually the Planck distribution, right? So what I should have, but our distribution actually looks this way. Now the other thing to notice is that the only part which is changing with time is actually this region here, right? So the near omega zero, not outside. Okay? So for the large frequencies, what's actually happening is what? This is actually getting frozen in time. So what you would usually expect is that what? If this is going to become more and more thermal, sure, early on you might have something that looks like this, but then as time increases, you would expect this would actually start to move down towards the Planck distribution, right? But as we can see, the only part that's moving or doing anything is actually the omega equals zero range, or goes to zero range.
Why would it move down? Because I mean, you keep creating particles. So there's no way for this to move down.
Well, it would move down, right. So what I mean is it would move down if this range here was actually time dependent as well.
Yeah, my point is that you don't really have plans on destroy particles. So whatever particle you've created is just there.
Right, right.
So, I mean, so it could be that okay, you produce some massive particle, or sorry, some high-energy particles early on, and they're not going anywhere. So just sitting, I don't know.
Right.
But so you have, after that, you may have Hawking radiation. But since you're adding up everything, then the early particles that you produce, they're just there.
Right, right. Well, I guess what I mean by that is to fit the Planck distribution, you would expect that this thing would have to move down with time. No, so that's what I mean. But
shouldn't you look at like a rate of particle production or something like that? Because that's what you expect from Hawking radiation.
Right, right. So yeah, you can look at the total energy, which is given off and all those different things. So that's actually something we're working on at this point in time. Okay. So I don't have anything really to say about that. Okay. So again, we can understand this, that this particular piece gets frozen in time because we know that these modes are just getting redshifted. Right. So my modes, which are initially induced, which are large, get redshifted down, and then they start to occupy this omega zero range. Right. So that's why that particular piece is time dependent, where the rest of it is actually not time dependent. Right. So basically, since it doesn't fit the Planck distribution, we can say, well, again, it's non-thermal, right? Even out in the tail. So the UV tail is actually non-thermal as well. So again, we can understand this using our Heisenberg picture. So out in that large frequency,
I mean, the analogy, what I'm saying is that, say, if you have two black holes merging,
okay,
you emit gravitational waves, right?
Right.
That has nothing to do with Hawking radiation.
Yes, right.
So in this case, it's a spherically symmetric, so you don't emit a gravitational wave.
Exactly.
You emit a scalar wave.
Right.
But accuracy is much, could be higher, and also the numbers could be certainly much, much higher.
But that goes away eventually.
But your doesn't go, where does it go?
Not at the regime.
No, but there is no observer here. This is adding up all the particles there, everywhere in the space. So it's a total number of particles.
Yeah, so in some sense, I mean, one perspective always thinking, correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Is you're saying you're calculating particle production due to a moving collapsing shell.
Right.
Then it's all well fine, but I guess what's confusing some of us is A, why should you expect that to be thermal? And B, how are you connecting that to Hawking radiation? Special sensors aren't in your state anyway.
Right.
You can postpone these till the end if you want.
Okay. Okay. I'll get back to those. Yeah. Okay. So just quickly. So again, we can understand this from the Heisenberg picture, right? So again, out in this regime, we know that the occupation number should be about zero, right? Again, we know that it's not changing in time, so the time derivative is about zero. So then we can just use the definitions of these anomalous creation annihilation operators, right? And then find that the occupation out in the UV spectrum also goes as 1 over omega, but there's also a oscillating piece which is attached to this as well. So this actually goes as more like cosine of omega over omega. Okay. So basically, the entire spectrum just goes as 1 over omega. Okay. So all the way through. So okay. So key points. So why do we find this? Well, basically, we find this because we are allowing for non-locality. And what I mean by that is, again, if we go back to this our actions, right? So again, we're taking the inside piece, right, from the inside, or the kinetic piece from the inside, the gradient piece from the outside, so automatically we have a kind of a non-locality going on, right? Because now it depends on fully the inside and the outside. Now again, since this depends on 1 over b, again, this is going to diverge strongly by the time this gets to the radius, right? So it actually turns out that this is actually the most important piece. So the most important piece actually comes from the inside, not from the outside, right? So say in a regular Hawking case, he ends up taking that the time limit goes to infinity, basically effectively tracing out all the modes from the inside, right? So only ones that have support are the outside modes, nothing from the inside. Where here, since this is the most dominant piece, this has support everywhere throughout, you know, from the inside and the outside for all time, right? At least until the t goes to infinity limit, right? So in that case, you should again cut off the inside modes, right, once time goes to infinity, and then you should recover exactly the Hawking spectrum at that point in time. Right? Because now the inside modes would have no support, right? Only outside modes. Another type of non-locality, again, is we wrote down these particular matrices. Right? So we said this is the matrix associated with the kinetic term. This is from the potential term. And we used a principal axis transformation to diagonalize these things. Okay? Well, it turns out that for small modes, right, this here, it's not diagonal, right? So we can make a diagonal, but in general, it's not diagonal. It actually will be a superposition of all of the modes, all the small modes in this particular range, right? So what he's actually measuring is not the definite momentum modes, but he's measuring actually modes which are from this, okay? So actually a complex superposition of all these modes, right? All right. And went out there. So implications towards the information paradox. Well, basically, what we're saying is that since the spectrum is non-thermal, which you imagine is as this thing is actually collapsing, it's giving off radiation. This radiation, since it's not thermal, can actually carry away information about this original collapsing state. Right? Now, we've seen some other things in prior work that I've done. There's also another non-locality. If I move to the infalling guy, right, riding on a shell, just quantizing the shell itself, once it passes the event horizon, there's actually a non-locality in the wave function. Okay? Moreover, there's actually a non-singularity once you get to the event horizon. I mean, not the event horizon, but the classical singularity. So quantizing the shell actually will smear out this classical singularity, right? Same thing that you would get in, say, a hydrogen atom. So now we have non-thermal radiation, which again is also good towards information paradox. But some things to look at is we're not exactly out of trouble yet. Okay? So basically what I mean by this is that this non-thermal behavior actually seems to be universal. And what I mean by that is we've looked at other cases. Right? So in this case, we only had a spherically symmetric shell which was collapsing. Now here, I can imagine instead of having just a spherically symmetric shell, I can now have it collapsing onto, say, a primordial black hole. Right? So I already have a pre-existing black hole. I allow the shell to collapse and then see what happens in this case. So again, I have an outside region 1. I have an inside region 2. Allow this thing to collapse. The only difference is now my inside metric is also Schwarzschild, but only depends on the mass of that inside, or the primordial black hole. The external now depends on the total mass, right? So the sum of the two masses. I can now play the same game where my Hamiltonian, at least for a single eigenmode, is given basically the same way, where P is basically the same thing as B was, but now it just depends on the total mass. Right? Again, I can show classically that the equation of motion is given the same way. So everything works out identically to the same situation. Right? So if my sum of the two masses is identical to the mass of just that one shell which was collapsing, then I can't tell the difference between them. Right? Or I can go a little more complicated. I can consider, say, two collapsing shells, where I have, say, one shell of mass 2, one shell of mass 1. Now I have three different regions. Outside is now going to depend on the sum of the two. Inside piece, or the middle piece, is only going to depend on the mass of the first one. And then the inside, again, is just going to be flat Minkowski. Right? Again, I can go through the same game, play everything the same way. And again, what I find is that the dominant piece is now just this B term again, which now depends on just the total mass of the two. Right? So again, everything works identically the same way. So universally speaking, meaning that, again, I can't tell now the difference between what type of situation I originally started with. Right? So I can't tell if I started off with just one shell, a shell falling onto a primordial black hole, or, say, two shells which are collapsing. So basically, we end up in exactly the same situation we were before. Right? So basically, now we have non-thermal radiation. But just because it's non-thermal doesn't really mean that it contains any information. Right? But what we would expect is that possibly information is actually embedded into higher correlations of these basis functions. So one thing you can argue is that the basis functions are going to be different depending on the different geometries that you have. Right? OK, so conclusions. So again, what we found is that the pre-Hawking radiation, or the radiation given off during the time of this collapse, is non-thermal. But the Rayleigh gene singularity seems to make it look like it becomes more and more thermal. The behavior is universal, meaning we can't distinguish the different scenarios from each other. But hopefully, we can at least get information out if we look at these higher order correlations. And so all this, like I said, coupled with those original things that we looked at, that physics on the inside becomes non-local and also becomes non-singular, then all these point to basically kind of a resolution of this information paradox. And that's it.
So I know nobody has used it, but there is this microphone.
No, I wasn't repeating the questions like I was supposed to.
Yeah. Maybe Eric can keep repeating the questions. Or we can pass that along. So, okay, yeah. So any questions?
Any more? Yes.
Can you explain the last point?
Nope.
Can you explain the last point about the information? You say that I couldn't understand really. You say that there is non-locality between the inside and outside.
Right.
Okay. So how you can so this is just qualitative way of that you have some release of information to the outside. But can you? Is there any way to quantitate this information? So for instance, for the state of the particles that you have. Can you define entropy for this and then say how much it is releasing?
Right. That's something I don't have an answer for at the moment. These are things that we're trying to work out at the moment. So first of all, right, how do you quantify the entropy? Where does the entropy come from? Right. How is this information correlated into, say, either higher correlations of the basis functions or any entropy or all these things? So these are things that we're currently trying to work out at the moment. I don't have a good answer at this point in time. But that's something we're working on, at least trying to figure out.
Okay. So very naive question. What's the criteria for your non-thermal definition? So you said that the observer goes to the shell and count the number of particles created.
Well, he doesn't go to the shell, so he still stays out at infinity. So basically, what you imagine is that he's out at infinity. He still has a detector, right? And he's detecting these particular particles which come to him, right? So basically, what he's saying is that, well, each one of these particles has a wave function associated with, right? So that's that original slide that I wrote down. He has his own wave function since he's out in, say, the ground state, which is not changing. That was that phi star b of n, right? So basically, every time he registers a particle, all he's doing is basically taking the overlap or the Gaussian overlap between his ground state and the wave function of the particle which comes to him. So that's how he's detecting what the particles are in this particular case. So I don't know if that kind of answers your question. But basically, that's all we're saying. So he's not going to the horizon and measuring anything there. So he's just measuring what comes to him, taking the Gaussian overlap between that wave function, right? Because that encodes all the information about the collapse, comparing that to his original, right, which would be the original of the system before it started, right? And then that's how he's getting his information. So all he's doing is watching this thing collapsing towards the Schwarzschild radius, right? So eventually, as this gets closer and closer to the Schwarzschild radius, you know, as far as he's concerned, the dynamics essentially stop, right? So because it takes an infinite amount of time for it to actually reach there. So he will never actually see this thing cross the Schwarzschild radius, at least hypothetically. Of course, you could probably have metric fluctuations or something which would cause it to form in a finite amount of time, but there's no concrete calculation of that. So that's more kind of speculation. But yeah, so if you ignore all that stuff, basically it would take an infinite amount of time for this thing to collapse. So yeah, so all he's doing is measuring the wave function which is carried to him by this particle, overlapping that with his detector, and then that's what he's measuring. If it's Hawking, yes. If it's Hawking, that's right. That's right, exactly. So yeah, if it's Hawking radiation which is given off, then you would expect it completely thermal. And that's what I meant by, so what you would expect is that as time increases, right, this thing should become more and more thermal because it should go to the Hawking calculation. But basically, as we're seeing, is that what's actually happening is the modes that are on the inside are actually getting stronger and stronger support, which is actually what's causing this non-thermality due to this basically non-locality. But if you go beyond the time goes to infinity limit, these modes from the inside should be completely cut off. So in that case, once time goes to infinity, then it should go directly to the Hawking calculation. But then you have other things you have to worry about, right? So would the shell actually evaporate before it ever reached that point, right? Because you have to take back reaction into account. This thing might actually evaporate. But then there's other things you have to worry about that too, right? So conservation of B minus L, for example. So if I had a shell which is made up of standard model particles, right? Could I actually have it evaporate before it actually reached there, right? Because I can't get rid of B minus L unless there's something beyond the standard model which will allow this thing to actually be able to completely evaporate. So best case scenario is what? This thing is collapsing, it sheds all the original information prior to the horizon forming, then it might, you know, still form a black hole, but there was no original information in that black hole to begin with. So, you know, the black hole can disappear, but who cares because I had no original information. Is kind of the best case scenario. So I guess what we're basically arguing is that, yeah, so this thing is collapsing, it's shedding information because it has non-thermal radiation until the horizon is formed. Then once the horizon is formed, then you can still have Hawking radiation, right? A regular Hawking calculation should then apply. But this thing is evaporating, but again, I don't have to worry about it, you know, particularly because it has no information encoded in it to begin with. Exactly, exactly, exactly.
So the problem I have with the number operator is that it's not really physical. I mean, even if you take one harmonic oscillator, you can choose coordinates in phase space. When you quantize using the Poisson brackets. So you can choose weird coordinates in phase space, and then you can get really weird creation and annihilation operators, and they'll give you just unphysical results.
Okay.
And this has, and people know that.
True.
So the only physical thing you could do is to, one, if you fix a quantum state, then you could look at how a detector would click.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's, to me, that's the only physically meaningful thing that you could do.
True. That's actually something I'm working on now. This is a project I'm working on with Tom Aviatch-Spate and Dejan Stojkovic. So we are redoing this whole entire calculation using the detector method, basically just for that particular reason. So Hawking's original calculation dealt with, you know, the number operator, the occupation number, right? So that's where the original came from. Then Unruh did the same calculation using, you know, the more physical detectors, and got the same exact answer, right? So that gave more validity to Hawking's original calculation. So that's exactly what we're trying to do now, right? So we did this in terms of this occupation number, but you're right. So to a certain extent, this has no real physical meaning until I do the two-point correlation function and do all that fun stuff. So that's actually something I'm working on with those two at this point in time to verify essentially this result.
I mean, I've seen examples, for example, in the Sitter space, where you could do funny things with number operator and you get the wrong answer.
True.
So it's
right.
I think it's something to worry
about. Yeah. Well, as I say, we're trying to do that at this point in time. Having some difficulty with it, but that's okay.
So, any other questions?
So, did you look at the time derivative of this n? Just maybe that looks more like Planck.
Not so much. The only time derivative we looked at was, you know, as time goes to like infinity and make sure that, you know, everything goes, you don't get any more production.
The part that's being actively radiated, that's the one that's linearly increases with time.
Right. Yeah. So that's something we should probably do. But yeah. But at this point in time, no. I haven't.
You already said that the high frequency part freezes. So that wouldn't contribute.
Right, that's true. That's true.
Because what I worry is exactly what I said, is that before you form the black hole, lots of stuff happened, and you can you can classically produce basically waves, not quantum mechanics. You just classically produce them. And those, that's of course not Hawking radiation. And usually it's much more than.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe it's premature then to say that it freezes.
it might freeze, but it's just that really two separate, completely separate pieces. There is this quantum, there's a classical part, and there's a quantum part. And the classical part just comes from the collapse phase, and the quantum part you keep generating it.
Right, but it's fairly symmetric. You wouldn't expect gravity waves or anything like that, right? So.
Well, here you have a scalar, so you have a scalar base. Yeah.
Okay. I think I understand your point. Okay.
Okay, so if there is no other question, let's thank Eric.
Thank you.